and have strayed among the trees for ever. But, much too soon, we heard the others laughing and talking and calling, "Where's Dora?" So we went back, and they wanted Dora to sing. Red Whisker would have got the guitar case out of the carriage, but Dora told him nobody knew where it was but I. So Red Whisker was done for in a moment, and I got it, and I unlocked it, and I took the guitar out, and I sat by her, and I held her handkerchief and gloves, and I drank in every note of her dear voice, and she sang to me, who loved her, and all the others might applaud as much as they liked, but they had nothing to do with it. I was intoxicated with joy. I was afraid it was too happy to be real, and that I should wake up in Buckingham Street presently and hear Mrs. Crupp clinking the teacups in getting the breakfast ready. But Dora sang, and others sang, and Miss Mills sang, about the slumbering echoes and the caverns of memory, as if she were 100 years old. And the evening came on, and we had tea, with the kettle boiling gypsy fashion, and I was still as happy as ever. I was happier than ever when the party broke up, and the other people defeated Red Whisker and all, went their several ways, and we went ours, through the still evening and the dying light, with sweet scents rising up around us. Mr. Spenlow, being a little drowsy after the champagne, honour to the soil that grew the grape that made the wine, to the sun that ripened it, and to the merchant who adulterated it, then being fast asleep in a corner of the carriage, I rode by the side and talked to Dora. She admired my horse and patted him. Oh, what a dear little hand it looked upon a horse. And her shawl wouldn't keep right, and now and then I drew it round her with my arm, and I even fancied that Jip began to see how it was and to understand that he must make up his mind to be friends with me. That sagacious Miss Mills, too. That amiable, though quite used-up, recluse. That little patriarch of something less than 20 who had done with the world and mustn't on any account have the slumbering echoes in the caverns of memory awakened. What a kind thing she did. "Mr. Copperfield," said Miss Mills, "come to this side of the carriage a moment, if you can spare a moment. I want to speak to you. Behold me on my gallant grey, bending at the side of Miss Mills with my hand upon the carriage door. Dora is coming to stay with me. She's coming home with me the day after tomorrow. If you would like to call, I'm sure Papa would be happy to see you." What could I do but invoke a silent blessing on Miss Mills's head, and store Miss Mills's address in the securest corner of my memory? What could I do but tell Miss Mills, with grateful looks and fervent words, how much I appreciated her good offices, and what an inestimable value I set upon her friendship? Then Miss Mills benignantly dismissed me, saying, "Go back to Dora." And I went. And Dora leant out of the carriage to talk to me, and we talked all the rest of the way. And I rode my gallant grey so close to the wheel that I grazed his near foreleg against it and took the bark off, as his owner told me, to the tune of £3.7, which I paid and thought extremely cheap for so much joy. What time Miss Mills sat looking at the moon, murmuring verses and recalling, I suppose, the ancient days when she and Earth had anything in common. Norwood was many miles too near, and we reached it many hours too soon. But Mr. Spenlow came to himself a little short of it and said, "You must come in, Copperfield, and rest." And I, consenting, we had sandwiches and wine and water. In the light room, Dora, blushing, looked so lovely that I couldn't tear myself away, but sat there staring in a dream until the snoring of Mr. Spenlow inspired me with sufficient consciousness to take my leave. So we parted. I, riding all the way to London with the farewell touch of Dora's hand still light on mine, recalling every incident and word 10,000 times, lying down in my own bed at last, as enraptured a young noodle as ever was carried out of his five wits by love. When I awoke next morning, I was resolute to declare my passion to Dora and know my fate. Happiness or misery was now the question. There was no other question that I knew of in the world, and only Dora could give the answer to it. I passed 3 days in a luxury of wretchedness, torturing myself by putting every conceivable variety of discouraging construction on all that had ever taken place between Dora and me. At last, arrayed for the purpose at a vast expense, I went to Miss Mills, fraught with a declaration. How many times I went up and down the street and round the square, painfully aware of being a much better answer to the old riddle than the original one, before I could persuade myself to go up the steps and knock is no matter now. Even when at last I had knocked and was waiting at the door, I had some flurried thought of asking if that were Mr. Blackboys, in imitation of poor Barkis, begging pardon and retreating. But I kept my ground. Mr. Mills was not at home. I didn't expect he would be. Nobody wanted him. Miss Mills was at home. Miss Mills would do. I was shown into a room upstairs where Miss Mills and Dora were. Jip was there. Miss Mills was copying music. I recollect it was a new song called Affection's Dirge, and Dora was painting flowers. What were my feelings when I recognised my own flowers, the identical Covent Garden Market purchase? I cannot say that they were very like, or that they particularly resembled any flowers that have ever come under my observation, but I knew from the paper round them, which was accurately copied, what the composition was. Miss Mills was very glad to see me, and very sorry her papa was not at home, though I thought we all bore that with fortitude. Miss Mills was conversational for a few minutes, and then, laying down her pen upon Affection's Dirge, got up and left the room. I began to think I would put it off till tomorrow. "I hope your poor horse wasn't tired when he got home at night," said Dora, lifting up her beautiful eyes. "It was a long way for him." I began to think I would do it today. "It was a long way for him," said I, "for he had nothing to uphold him on the journey." "Wasn't he fed, poor thing?" asked Dora. I began to think I would put it off till tomorrow. "Yes, yes," I said, he was well taken care of. I mean, not the unutterable happiness that I had in being so near you." Dora bent her head over her drawing and said after a little while, I had sat in the interval in a burning fever and with my legs in a very rigid state, "You didn't seem to be sensible of that happiness yourself at one time of the day." I saw now that I was in for it, and it must be done on the spot. "You didn't care for that happiness in the least," said Dora, slightly raising her eyebrows and shaking her head, "when you were sitting by Miss Kit." Kit, I should observe, was the name of the creature in pink, with little eyes. "There's certain, I don't know why you should," said Dora, "or why you should call it a happiness at all. But of course you don't mean what you say, and I'm sure no one doubts your being at liberty to do whatever you like. Jip, you naughty boy, come here." I don't know how I did it. I did it in a moment. I intercepted Jip. I had Dora in my arms. I was full of eloquence. I never stopped for a word. I told her how I loved her. I told her I should die without her. I told her that I idolized and worshipped her. Jip barked madly all the time. When Dora hung her head and cried and trembled, my eloquence increased so much the more. If she would like me to die for her, she had but to say the word, and I was ready. Life without Dora's love was not a thing to have on any terms. I couldn't bear it, and I wouldn't. I had loved her every minute, day and night, since I first saw her. I loved her at that minute to distraction. I should always love her every minute to distraction. Lovers had loved before, and lovers would love again, but no lover had ever loved, might, could, would, or should ever love, as I loved Dora. The more I raved, the more Jip barked. Each of us, in his own way, got more mad every moment. Well, well, Dora and I were sitting on the sofa by and by, quiet enough, and Jip was lying in her lap, winking peacefully at me. It was off my mind. I was in a state of perfect rapture. Dora and I were engaged. I suppose we had some notion that this was to end in marriage. We must have had some, because Dora stipulated that we were never to be married without her papa's consent. But, in our youthful ecstasy, I don't think that we really looked before us or behind us, or had any aspiration beyond the ignorant present. We were to keep our secret from Mr. Spenlow. But I'm sure the idea never entered my head then that there was anything dishonourable in that. Miss Mills was more than usually pensive when Dora, going to find her, brought her back. I apprehend because there was a tendency in what had passed to awaken the slumbering echoes and the caverns of memory. But she gave us her blessing and the assurance of her lasting friendship, and spoke to us generally as became a voice from the cloister. What an idle time it was! What an unsubstantial, happy, foolish time it was! When I measured Dora's finger for a ring that was to be made of forget-me-nots, and when the jeweller to whom I took the measure found me out and laughed over his order-book and charged me anything he liked for the pretty little toy with its blue stones, so associated in my remembrance with Dora's hand that yesterday, when I saw such another by chance on the finger of my own daughter, there was a momentary stirring in my heart like pain. When I walked about, exulting with my secret and full of my own interest, and felt the dignity of loving Dora and of being beloved so much that if I'd walked the air, I couldn't have been more above the people not so situated who were creeping on the earth. When we had those meetings in the garden of the square, and sat within the dingy summer house, so happy that I love the London sparrows to this hour for nothing else, and see the plumage of the tropics in their smoky feathers. When we had our first great quarrel within a week of our betrothal, and when Dora sent me back the ring enclosed in a despairing cocked hat note, wherein she used the terrible expression that our love had begun in folly and ended in madness, which dreadful words occasioned me to tear my hair and cry that all was over. When, under cover of the night, I flew to Miss Mills, whom I saw by stealth in a back kitchen where there was a mangle, and implored Miss Mills to interpose between us and avert insanity. When Miss Mills undertook the office, and returned with Dora, exhorting us from the pulpit of her own bitter youth to mutual concession and the avoidance of the desert of Sahara. When we cried and made it up, and were so blessed again that the back kitchen, mangle and all, changed to love's own temple, where we arranged a plan of correspondence through Miss Mills, always to comprehend at least one letter on each side every day. What an idle time! What an unsubstantial, happy, foolish time! Of all the times of mine that time has in his grip, there is none that in one retrospection I can smile at half so much and think of half so tenderly. Chapter 34. My aunt astonishes me. I wrote to Agnes as soon as Dora and I were engaged. I wrote her a long letter in which I tried to make her comprehend how blessed I was and what a darling Dora was. I entreated Agnes not to regard this as a thoughtless passion which could ever yield to any other, or had the least resemblance to the boyish fancies that we used to joke about. I assured her that its profundity was quite unfathomable, and expressed my belief that nothing like it had ever been known. Somehow, as I wrote to Agnes on a fine evening by my open window, and the remembrance of her clear, calm eyes and gentle face came stealing over me, it shed such a peaceful influence upon the hurry and agitation in which I'd been living lately, and of which my very happiness partook in some degree, that it soothed me into tears. I remember that I sat resting my head upon my hand when the letter was half done, cherishing a general fancy as if Agnes were one of the elements of my natural home. As if, in the retirement of the housemaid almost sacred to me by her presence, Dora and I must be happier than anywhere. As if, in love, joy, sorrow, hope, or disappointment, in all emotions, my heart turned naturally there and found its refuge and best friend. Of Steerforth I said nothing. I only told her there had been sad grief at Yarmouth on account of Emily's flight, and that on me it made a double wound by reason of the circumstances attending it. I knew how quick she always was to divine the truth, and that she would never be the first to breathe his name. To this letter I received an answer by return of post. As I read it, I seemed to hear Agnes speaking to me. It was like her cordial voice in my ears. What can I say more?
This ends side one of cassette 16. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
While I had been away from home, lately Traddles had called twice or thrice, finding Peggotty within and being informed by Peggotty, who always volunteered that information to whomsoever would receive it, that she was my old nurse, he had established a good-humoured acquaintance with her, and had stayed to have a little chat with her about me. So Peggotty said, but I'm afraid the chat was all on her own side and of immoderate length, as she was very difficult indeed to stop, God bless her, when she had me for her theme. This reminds me not only that I expected Traddles on a certain afternoon of his own appointing, which was now come, but that Mrs. Crupp had resigned everything appertaining to her office, the salary excepted, until Peggotty should cease to present herself. Mrs. Crupp, after holding divers conversations respecting Peggotty in a very high-pitched voice on the staircase, with some invisible familiar, it would appear, for corporeally speaking she was quite alone at those times, addressed a letter to me developing her views, beginning it with that statement of universal application, which fitted every occurrence of her life, namely that she was a mother herself. She went on to inform me that she had once seen very different days, but that at all periods of her existence she had had a constitutional objection to spies, intruders, and informers. She named no names, she said. Let them the cap-fitted wear it. But spies, intruders, and informers, especially in widders' weeds, this clause was underlined, she had ever accustomed herself to look down upon. If a gentleman was the victim of spies, intruders, and informers, but still naming no names, that was his own pleasure. He had a right to please himself, so let him do. All that she, Mrs. Crupp, stipulated for was that she should not be brought in contract with such persons. Therefore, she begged to be excused from any further attendance on the top set until things was as they formerly was and as they could be wished to be. I further mentioned that her little book would be found upon the breakfast table every Saturday morning, when she requested an immediate settlement of the same, with the benevolent view of saving trouble and an ill convenience to all parties. After this, Mrs. Crupp confined herself to making pitfalls on the stairs, principally with pictures, and endeavouring to delude Peggotty into breaking her legs. I found it rather harassing to live in this state of siege, but was too much afraid of Mrs. Crupp to see any way out of it. "My dear Copperfield," said Traddles, punctually appearing at my door in spite of all these obstacles, "how'd you do?" "My dear Traddles," said I, "I'm delighted to see you at last, and very sorry I've not been at home before, but I've been so much engaged..." "Yes, yes, I know," said Traddles. "Of course, yours lives in London, I think." "What did you say?" "Excuse me, Miss D, you know," said Traddles, colouring in his great delicacy, "lives in London, I believe." "Oh, yes, near London." "Mine perhaps you recollect, said Traddles with a serious look, lives down in Devonshire. 1 of 10. Consequently, I am not so much engaged as you, in that sense. I wonder you can bear I return to see her so seldom. Ah, said Traddles thoughtfully, it does seem a wonder. I suppose it is Copperfield because there's no help for it. I suppose so, I replied with a smile, and not without a blush, and because you have so much constancy and patience, Traddles. Dear me, said Traddles, considering about it, do I strike you in that way, Copperfield? Really, I didn't know that I had, but she's such an extraordinarily dear girl herself that it's possible she may have imparted something of those virtues to me. Now you mention it, Copperfield, I shouldn't wonder at all. I assure you she's always forgetting herself and taking care of the other 9. Is she the eldest? I inquired. Oh, dear no, said Traddles, the eldest is a beauty. He saw, I suppose, that I couldn't help smiling at the simplicity of this reply, and added with a smile upon his own ingenuous face, not, of course, but that my Sophie... Pretty name, Copperfield, I always think. Very pretty, said I. Not, of course, but that Sophie is beautiful too, in my eyes, and would be one of the dearest girls that ever was in anybody's eyes, I should think. But when I say the eldest is a beauty, I mean she really is a... He seemed to be describing clouds about himself with both hands. Splendid, you know, said Traddles energetically. Indeed, said I. Oh, I assure you, said Traddles, something very uncommon indeed. Then, you know, being formed for society and admiration and not being able to enjoy much of it, in consequence of their limited means, she naturally gets a little irritable and exacting sometimes. Sophie puts her in good humour. Is Sophie the youngest? I hazarded. Oh, dear no, said Traddles, stroking his chin. The 2 youngest are only 9 and 10. Sophie educates them. The second daughter, perhaps? I hazarded. No, said Traddles. Sarah's the second. Sarah has something the matter with her spine, poor girl. The malady'll wear out by and by, the doctors say. But in the meantime, she has to lie down for a 12-month. Sophie nurses her. Sophie's the 4th. Is the mother living? I inquired. Oh, yes, said Traddles. She's alive. She's a very superior woman indeed. But the damp country is not adapted to her constitution and... In fact, she's lost the use of her limbs. Dear me, said I. Very sad, is it not? Returned Travels. But in a merely domestic view, it's not so bad as it might be, because Sophie takes her place. She's quite as much a mother to her mother as she is to the other 9. I felt the greatest admiration for the virtues of this young lady, and honestly, with the view of doing my best to prevent the good nature of Traddles from being imposed upon, to the detriment of their joint prospects in life, inquired how Mr. Micawber was. "He's quite well, Copperfield, thank you," said Traddles. "I'm not living with him at present." "No? No. You see, the truth is," said Traddles in a whisper, "he's changed his name to Mortimer in consequence of his temporary embarrassments, and he don't come out until after dark, and then in spectacles. There was an execution put into our house for rent. Mrs. Micawber was in such a dreadful state that I really couldn't resist giving my name to that second bill we spoke of here. You may imagine how delightful it was to my feelings, Copperfield, to see the matter settled with it and Mrs. Micawber recover her spirits." Said I. "Not that her happiness was of long duration," pursued Traddles, "for unfortunately, within a week another execution came in. He'd broke up the establishment. I've been living in a furnished apartment since then, and the Mortimers have been very private indeed. I hope you won't think it selfish, Copperfield, if I mention that the broker carried off my little round table with the marble top and Sophie's flower-pot and stand." "What a hard thing!" I exclaimed indignantly. It was a pull, said Traddles, with his usual wince at that expression. I don't mention it reproachfully, however, but with a motive. The fact is, Copperfield, I was unable to repurchase them at the time of their seizure. In the first place, because the broker, having an idea that I wanted them, ran the price up to an extravagant extent. And in the second place, because I hadn't any money. Now I've kept my eyes since upon the broker's shop, said Travels, with a great enjoyment of his mystery, which is up at the top of Tottenham Court Road, and at last, today, I find them put out for sale. I've only noticed them from over the way, because if the broker saw me, bless you, he'd ask any price for them. What has occurred to me, having now the money, is that perhaps you wouldn't object to ask that good nurse of yours to come with me to the shop. I can show it to her from round the corner of the next street, and make the best bargain for them as if they were for herself that she can. The delight with which Traddles propounded this plan to me, and the sense he had of its uncommon artfulness, are among the freshest things in my remembrance. I told him that my old nurse would be delighted to assist him, and that we would all three take the field together, but on one condition. That condition was that he should make a solemn resolution to grant no more loans of his name or anything else to Mr. Micawber. My dear Copperfield, said Traddles, I've already done so, because I begin to feel that I have not only been inconsiderate, but that I have been positively unjust to Sophie. My word being passed to myself, there is no longer any apprehension, but I pledge it to you two with the greatest readiness. That first unlucky obligation I have paid. I have no doubt Mr. Micawber would have paid it if he could, but he could not. One thing I ought to mention, which I very much like in Mr. Micawber, Copperfield, it refers to the second obligation, which is not yet due. He don't tell me that it is provided for, but he says it will be. Now, I think there's something very fair and honest about that. I was unwilling to damp my good friend's confidence, and therefore assented. After a little further conversation, we went round to the chandler's shop to enlist Peggotty. Traddles declining to pass the evening with me, both because he endured the liveliest apprehensions that his property would be bought by somebody else before he could repurchase it, and because it was the evening he always devoted to writing to the dearest girl in the world. I never shall forget him peeping round the corner of the street in Tottenham Court Road, while Peggotty was bargaining for the precious articles, or his agitation when she came slowly towards us after vainly offering a price, and was hailed by the relenting broker and went back again. The end of the negotiation was that she bought the property on tolerably easy terms, and Traddles was transported with pleasure. "I'm very much obliged to you indeed," said Traddles, on hearing it was to be sent to where he lived that night. "If I might ask you one other favour, I hope you wouldn't think it absurd, Copperfield." I said beforehand, "Certainly not." "Then, if you would be good enough," said Traddles to Peggotty, "to get the flower pot now, I think I should like, it being Sophie's, Copperfield, to carry it home myself." Peggotty was glad to get it for him, and he overwhelmed her with thanks and went his way up Tottenham Court Road, carrying the flower pot affectionately in his arms, with one of the most delighted expressions of countenance I ever saw. We then turned back towards my chambers. As the shops had charms for Peggotty, which I never knew them possess in the same degree for anybody else, I sauntered easily along, amused by her staring in at the windows, and waiting for her as often as she chose. We were thus a good while in getting to the Adelphi. On our way upstairs, I called her attention to the sudden disappearance of Mrs. Crupp's pitfalls, and also to the prints of recent footsteps. We were both very much surprised, coming higher up, to find my outer door standing open, which I had shut, and to hear voices inside. We looked at one another without knowing what to make of this, and went into the sitting-room. What was my amazement to find, of all people upon earth, my aunt there and Mr. Dick. My aunt, sitting on a quantity of luggage, with her two birds before her, and her cat on her knee, like a female Robinson Crusoe drinking tea. Mr. Dick, leaning thoughtfully on a great kite, such as we had often been out together to fly, with more luggage piled about him. "My dear aunt," cried I, "why, what an unexpected pleasure!" We cordially embraced, and Mr. Dick and I cordially shook hands, and Mrs. Crupp, who was busy making tea and couldn't be too attentive, cordially said she had knowed well as Mr. Copperfull would have his heart in his mouth when he sees his dear relations. "Hello!" said my aunt to Peggotty, who quailed before her awful presence. "How are you?" "You remember my aunt, Peggotty," said I. "For the love of goodness, child," exclaimed my aunt, "don't call the woman by that South Sea Island name. If she married and got rid of it, which was the best thing she could do, why don't you give her the benefit of the change? What's your name now?" "P," said my aunt, as a compromise for the obnoxious appellation. "Farkas, ma'am," said Peggotty with a curtsy. "Well, that's human," said my aunt. "It sounds less as if you wanted a missionary. How do you do, Barkis? I hope you're well." Encouraged by these gracious words, and by my aunt's extending her hand, Barkis came forward and took the hand, and curtsied her acknowledgements. "We are older than we were, I see," said my aunt. "We have only met each other once before, you know. A nice business we made of it then. Trot, my dear, another cup." I handed it dutifully to my aunt, who was in her usual inflexible state of figure, and ventured a remonstrance with her on the subject of her sitting on a box. "Let me draw the sofa here, or the easy chair, aunt," said I. "Why should you be so uncomfortable?" "Thank you, Trot," replied my aunt. "I prefer to sit upon my property." Here my aunt looked hard at Mrs. Crupp and observed, "We needn't trouble you to wait, ma'am."
"Shall I put a little more tea in the pot before I go, ma'am?"
said Mrs. Crupp.
"No, I thank you, ma'am," replied my aunt. "Would you let me fetch another pat of butter, ma'am?" said Mrs. Crupp. "Or would you be persuaded to try a new-laid egg? Or should I brile a rasher? Ain't there nothing I could do for your dear aunt, Mr. Copperfull?"
"Nothing, ma'am," returned my aunt. "I shall do very well, I thank you." Mrs. Crupp, who had been incessantly smiling to express sweet temper, and incessantly holding her head on one side to express a general feebleness of constitution, and incessantly rubbing her hands to express a desire to be of service to all deserving objects, gradually smiled herself, one-sided herself, and rubbed herself out of the room. "Dick," said my aunt, "you know what I told you about time-servers and wealth-worshippers." Mr. Dick, with rather a scared look, as if he'd forgotten it, returned a hasty answer in the affirmative. "Mrs. Crupp is one of them," said my aunt. "Barkis, I'll trouble you to look after the tea and let me have another cup, for I don't fancy that woman's pouring out." I knew my aunt sufficiently well to know that she had something of importance on her mind, and that there was far more matter in this arrival than a stranger might have supposed. I noticed how her eye lighted on me when she thought my attention otherwise occupied, and what a curious process of hesitation appeared to be going on within her while she preserved her outward stiffness and composure. I began to reflect whether I had done anything to offend her, and my conscience whispered me that I had not yet told her about Dora. Could it by any means be that, I wondered? As I knew she would only speak in her own good time, I sat down near her and spoke to the birds and played with the cat and was as easy as I could be. But I was very far from being really easy. And I should still have been so, even if Mr. Dick, leaning over the great kite behind my aunt, had not taken every secret opportunity of shaking his head darkly at me and pointing at her. "Trot," said my aunt at last, when she'd finished her tea and carefully smoothed down her dress and wiped her lips. "You needn't go, Barkis. Trot, have you got to be firm and self-reliant?" "I hope so, aunt." "What do you think?" inquired Miss Betsy.
"I think so, aunt."
"Then why, my love," said my aunt, looking earnestly at me, "why do you think I prefer to sit upon this property of mine tonight?" I shook my head, unable to guess. "Because," said my aunt, "it's all I have. Because I am ruined, my dear.
If the house and every one of us had tumbled out into the river together, I could hardly have received a greater shock. Dick knows it, said my aunt, laying her hand calmly on my shoulder. I am ruined, my dear Trot. All I have in the world is in this room except the cottage, and that I have left Janet to let. Barkis, I want to get a bed for this gentleman tonight. To save expense, perhaps you can make up something here for myself. Anything will do. It's only for tonight. We'll talk about this more tomorrow. I was roused from my amazement and concern for her, I'm sure for her, by her falling on my neck for a moment and crying that she only grieved for me. In another moment she suppressed this emotion and said, with an aspect more triumphant than dejected, "We must meet reverses boldly and not suffer them to frighten us, my dear. We must learn to act the play out. We must live misfortune down, Trot." Chapter 35. Depression. As soon as I could recover my presence of mind, which quite deserted me in the first overpowering shock of my aunt's intelligence, I proposed to Mr. Dick to come round to the chandler's shop and take possession of the bed which Mr. Peggotty had lately vacated. The chandler's shop being in Hungerford Market, and Hungerford Market being a very different place in those days, there was a low wooden colonnade before the door, not very unlike that before the house where the little man and woman used to live in the old weather glass, which pleased Mr. Dick mightily. The glory of lodging over this structure would have compensated him, I dare say, for many inconveniences, but as there were really few to bear beyond the compound of flavours I've already mentioned, and perhaps the want of a little more elbow room, he was perfectly charmed with his accommodation. Mrs. Crupp had indignantly assured him that there wasn't room to swing a cat there. But, as Mr. Dick justly observed to me, sitting down on the foot of the bed nursing his leg, "You know, Trotwood, I don't want to swing a cat. I never do swing a cat. Therefore, what does that signify to me?" I tried to ascertain whether Mr. Dick had any understanding of the causes of this sudden and great change in my aunt's affairs. As I might have expected, he had none at all. The only account he could give of it was that my aunt had said to him the day before yesterday, "Now, Dick, are you really and truly the philosopher I take you for?" That then he'd said, yes, he hoped so. That then my aunt had said, "Dick, I am ruined." That then he had said, "Oh, indeed." That then my aunt had praised him highly, which he was very glad of. And that then they'd come to me and had had bottled porter and sandwiches on the road. Mr. Dick was so very complacent, sitting on the foot of the bed, nursing his leg and telling me this, with his eyes wide open and a surprised smile, that I'm sorry to say I was provoked into explaining to him that ruin meant distress, want, and starvation. But I was soon bitterly reproved for this harshness by seeing his face turn pale and tears course down his lengthened cheeks, while he fixed upon me a look of such unutterable woe that it might have softened a far harder heart than mine. I took infinitely greater pains to cheer him up again than I'd taken to depress him, and I soon understood, as I ought to have known at first, that he had been so confident, merely because of his faith in the wisest and most wonderful of women, and his unbounded reliance on my intellectual resources. The latter, I believe, he considered a match for any kind of disaster, not absolutely mortal. "What can we do, Trotwood?" said Mr. Dick. "There's the memorial." "To be sure there is," said I. "But all we can do just now, Mr. Dick, is to keep a cheerful countenance and not let my aunt see that we're thinking about it." He assented to this in the most earnest manner, and implored me, if I should see him wandering an inch out of the right course, to recall him by some of those superior methods which were always at my command. But I regret to state that the fright I'd given him proved too much for his best attempts at concealment. All the evening his eyes wandered to my aunt's face with an expression of the most dismal apprehension, as if he saw her growing thin on the spot. He was conscious of this, and put a constraint upon his head, But his keeping that immovable and sitting rolling his eyes like a piece of machinery didn't mend the matter at all. I saw him look at the loaf at supper, which happened to be a small one, as if nothing else stood between us and famine. And when my aunt insisted on his making his customary repast, I detected him in the act of pocketing fragments of his bread and cheese. I have no doubt for the purpose of reviving us with those savings when we should have reached an advanced stage of attenuation. My aunt, on the other hand, was in a composed frame of mind, which was a lesson to all of us. To me, I'm sure. She was extremely gracious to Peggotty, except when I inadvertently called her by that name. And strange as I knew she felt in London, appeared quite at home. She was to have my bed, and I was to lie in the sitting-room to keep guard over her. She made a great point of being so near the river in case of a conflagration, and I suppose really did find some satisfaction in that circumstance. "Trot, my dear," said my aunt, when she saw me making preparations for compounding her usual night draught. "No." "Nothing, aunt?" "Not wine, my dear. Ale." "There is wine here, aunt, and you always have it made of wine." "Keep that in case of sickness," said my aunt. "We mustn't use it carelessly, Trot. Ale for me, half a pint." I thought Mr. Dick would have fallen insensible. My aunt being resolute, I went out and got the ale myself. As it was growing late, Peggotty and Mr. Dick took that opportunity of repairing to the chandler's shop together. I parted from him, poor fellow, at the corner of the street, with his great kite at his back, a very monument of human misery. My aunt was walking up and down the room when I returned, crimping the borders of her nightcap with her fingers. I warmed the ale and made the toast on the usual infallible principles. When it was ready for her, she was ready for it, with her nightcap on, and the skirt of her gown turned back on her knees. "My dear," said my aunt, after taking a spoonful of it, "it's a great deal better than wine. Not half so bilious." I suppose I looked doubtful, for she added, "Tut, tut, child. If nothing worse than ale happens to us, we're well off." "I should think so myself, aunt, I'm sure," said I. "Well, then why don't you think so?" said my aunt. "Because you and I are very different people," I returned. "Stuff and nonsense, Trot," replied my aunt. My aunt went on with a quiet enjoyment, in which there was very little affectation, if any, drinking the warm ale with a teaspoon and soaking her strips of toast in it. "Trot," said she, "I don't care for strange faces in general, but I rather like that Barkis of yours, you know." "It's better than £100 to hear you say so," said I. "It's a most extraordinary world," observed my aunt, rubbing her nose. "How that woman ever got into it with that name is unaccountable to me. It would have been much more easy to be born a Jackson or something of that sort, one would think." "Perhaps she thinks so, too. It's not her fault," said I. "I suppose not," returned my aunt, rather grudging the admission. "But it's very aggravating. However, she's Barkis now. That's some comfort. Barkis is uncommonly fond of you, Trot." "There's nothing she would leave undone to prove it," said I. "Nothing, I believe," returned my aunt. "Here the poor fool has been begging and praying about handing over some of her money because she's got too much of it. A simpleton!" My aunt's tears of pleasure were positively trickling down into the warm ale. "She's the most ridiculous creature that ever was born," said my aunt. "I knew from the first moment when I saw her with that poor, dear, blessed baby of a mother of yours that she was the most ridiculous of mortals. But there are good points in Barkis." Affecting to laugh, she got an opportunity of putting her hand to her eyes. Having availed herself of it, she resumed her toast and her discourse together. "Ah! Mercy upon us," sighed my aunt. "I know all about it, Trot. Barkis and myself had quite a gossip while you were out with Dick. I know all about it. I don't know where these wretched girls expect to go to, for my part. I wonder they don't knock out their brains against mantelpieces," said my aunt, an idea which was probably suggested to her by her contemplation of mine. "Poor Emily," said I. "Oh, don't talk to me about poor," returned my aunt. "She should have thought of that before she caused so much misery. Give me a kiss, Trot. I'm sorry for your early experience." As I bent forward, she put a tumbler on my knee to detain me and said, "Oh, Trot, Trot. And so you fancy yourself in love, do you?" "Fancy, aunt?" I exclaimed, as red as I could be. "I adore her with my whole soul." "Dora, indeed," returned my aunt. "And you mean to say the little thing is very fascinating, I suppose?" "My dear aunt," I replied, "no one can form the least idea what she is." "Ah! And not silly," said my aunt. "Silly, aunt?" I seriously believe it had never once entered my head for a single moment to consider whether she was or not. I resented the idea, of course, but I was in a manner struck by it as a new one altogether. "Not light-headed?" said my aunt. "Light-headed, aunt?" I could only repeat this daring speculation with the same kind of feeling with which I had repeated the preceding question. "Well, well," said my aunt, "I only ask. I don't depreciate her. Poor little couple. And so you think you were formed for one another and are to go through a party supper table kind of life like two pretty pieces of confectionery, do you, Trot?" She asked me this so kindly and with such a gentle air, half playful and half sorrowful, that I was quite touched. "We are young and inexperienced, aunt, I know," I replied. "And I dare say we say and think a good deal that is rather foolish. But we love one another truly, I'm sure. If I thought Dora could ever love anybody else or cease to love me, or that I could ever love anybody else or cease to love her, I don't know what I should do. Go out of my mind, I think." "Ah, Trot," said my aunt, shaking her head and smiling gravely. "Blind, blind, blind. Someone that I know, Trot," my aunt pursued after a pause, "though of a very pliant disposition, has an earnestness of affection in him that reminds me of poor baby. Earnestness is what that somebody must look for, to sustain him and improve him, Trot. Deep, downright, faithful earnestness." "If you only knew the earnestness of Dora, aunt," I cried. "Oh, Trot," she said again, "blind, blind." And without knowing why, I felt a vague, unhappy loss or want of something overshadow me like a cloud. "However," said my aunt, "I don't want to put two young creatures out of conceit with themselves, or to make them unhappy. So, though it's a girl and boy attachment, and girl and boy attachments very often, mind, I don't say always, come to nothing, still, we'll be serious about it, and hope for a prosperous issue one of these days. There's time enough for it to come to anything." This was not, upon the whole, very comforting to a rapturous lover, but I was glad to have my aunt in my confidence, and I was mindful of her being fatigued. So I thanked her ardently for this mark of her affection, and for all her other kindnesses towards me. And after a tender good night, she took her nightcap into my bedroom. How miserable I was when I lay down. How I thought and thought about my being poor in Mr. Spenlow's eyes, about my not being what I thought I was when I proposed to Dora, about the chivalrous necessity of telling Dora what my worldly condition was, and releasing her from her engagement if she thought fit, about how I should contrive to live during the long term of my articles when I was earning nothing, about doing something to assist my aunt and seeing no way of doing anything, about coming down to have no money in my pocket, and to wear a shabby coat, and to be able to carry Dora no little presents, and to ride no gallant greys, and to show myself in no agreeable light. Sordid and selfish as I knew it was,
And as I tortured myself by knowing that it was, to let my mind run on my own distress so much, I was so devoted to Dora that I couldn't help it. I knew that it was base in me not to think more of my aunt and less of myself. But so far selfishness was inseparable from Dora, and I could not put Dora on one side for any mortal creature. How exceedingly miserable I was that night. As to sleep, I had dreams of poverty in all sorts of shapes, but I seemed to dream without the previous ceremony of going to sleep. Now I was ragged, wanting to sell Dora matches, 6 bundles for a halfpenny. Now I was at the office in a nightgown and boots, remonstrated with by Mr. Spenlow on appearing before the clients in that airy attire. Now I was hungrily picking up the crumbs that fell from old Tiffy's daily biscuit, regularly eaten when St. Paul's struck one. Now I was hopelessly endeavouring to get a license to marry Dora, having nothing but one of Uriah Heep's gloves to offer in exchange, which the whole commons rejected. And still more or less conscious of my own room, I was always tossing about like a distressed ship in a sea of bedclothes. My aunt was restless too, for I frequently heard her walking to and fro. 2 or 3 times in the course of the night, attired in a long flannel wrapper in which she looked 7 feet high, she appeared like a disturbed ghost in my room and came to the side of the sofa on which I lay. On the first occasion I started up in alarm to learn that she inferred from a particular light in the sky that Westminster Abbey was on fire, and to be consulted in reference to the probability of its igniting Buckingham Street in case the wind changed. Lying still after that, I found that she sat down near me, whispering to herself, "Poor boy." And then it made me 20 times more wretched to know how unselfishly mindful she was of me, and how selfishly mindful I was of myself. It was difficult to believe that a night so long to me could be short to anybody else. This consideration set me thinking and thinking of an imaginary party where people were dancing hours away, until that became a dream too, and I heard the music incessantly playing one tune, and saw Dora incessantly dancing one dance without taking the least notice of me. The man who had been playing the harp all night was trying in vain to cover it with an ordinary-sized nightcap when I awoke. Or I should rather say, when I left off trying to go to sleep and saw the sun shining in through the window at last. There was an old Roman bath in those days at the bottom of one of the streets out of the Strand, it may be there still, in which I have had many a cold plunge. Dressing myself as quietly as I could, and leaving Peggotty to look after my aunt, I tumbled head foremost into it, and then went for a walk to Hampstead. I had hope that this brisk treatment might freshen my wits a little, and I think it did them good, for I soon came to the conclusion that the first step I ought to take was to try if my articles could be cancelled and the premium recovered. I got some breakfast on the heath and walked back to Doctor's Commons, along the watered roads and through a pleasant smell of summer flowers growing in gardens and carried into town on hucksters' heads, intent on this first effort to meet our altered circumstances. I arrived at the office so soon, after all, that I had 30 minutes loitering about the commons before old Tiffy, who was always first, appeared with his key. Then I sat down in my shady corner, looking up at the sunlight on the opposite chimney-pots, and thinking about Dora, until Mr. Spenlow came in crisp and curly. "How are you, Copperfield?" said he. "Fine morning." "Beautiful morning, sir," said I. "Could I say a word to you before you go into court?" "By all means," said he. "Come into my room." I followed him into his room, and he began putting on his gown and touching himself up before a little glass he had hanging inside a closet door. "I'm sorry to say," said I, "that I have some rather disheartening intelligence from my aunt." "No," said he. "Dear me, not paralysis, I hope." "It has no reference to her health, sir," I replied. "She has met with some large losses. In fact, she has very little left indeed." "You astound me, Copperfield," cried Mr. Spenlow.
I shook my head. "Indeed, sir," said I, "her affairs are so changed that I wish to ask you whether it would be possible, at a sacrifice on our part of some portion of the premium, of course." I put in this on the spur of the moment, warned by the blank expression of his face, "to cancel my articles." What it cost me to make this proposal, nobody knows. It was like asking, as a favour, to be sentenced to transportation from Dora. "To cancel your articles, Copperfield?" "Cancel?" I explained with tolerable firmness that I really didn't know where my means of subsistence were to come from unless I could earn them for myself. "I had no fear for the future," I said, and I laid great emphasis on that, as if to imply that I should still be decidedly eligible for a son-in-law one of these days. "But for the present I was thrown upon my own resources." "I'm extremely sorry to hear this, Copperfield," said Mr. Spenlow, "extremely sorry. It is not usual to cancel articles for any such reason. It is not a professional course of proceeding. It's not a convenient precedent at all. Far from it. At the same time..." "You're very good, sir," I murmured, anticipating a concession. "Not at all. Don't mention it," said Mr. Spenlow. "At the same time, I was going to say, if it had been my lot to have my hands unfettered, if I had not a partner, Mr. Jorkins..." My hopes were dashed in a moment, but I made another effort. "Do you think, sir," said I, "if I were to mention it to Mr. Jorkins..." Mr. Spenlow shook his head discouragingly. "Heaven forbid, Copperfield," he replied, "that I should do any man an injustice, still less Mr. Jorkins. But I know my partner, Copperfield. Mr. Jorkins is not a man to respond to a proposition of this peculiar nature. Mr. Jorkins is very difficult to move from the beaten track. You know what he is. I'm sure I knew nothing about him, except that he had originally been alone in the business and now lived by himself in a house near Montague Square, which was fearfully in want of painting, that he came very late of a day and went away very early, that he never appeared to be consulted about anything, and that he had a dingy little black hole of his own upstairs where no business was ever done, and where there was a yellow old cartridge paper pad upon his desk, unsoiled by ink and reported to be 20 years of age. Would you object to my mentioning it to him, sir?" I asked. "By no means," said Mr. Spenlow, "but I have some experience of Mr. Jorkins, Copperfield. I wish it were otherwise, for I should be happy to meet your views in any respect. I cannot have the least objection to your mentioning it to Mr. Jorkins, Copperfield, if you think it worthwhile." Availing myself of this permission, which was given with a warm shake of the hand, I sat thinking about Dora and looking at the sunlight stealing from the chimney pots down the wall of the opposite house, until Mr. Jorkins came. I then went up to Mr. Jorkins' room, and evidently astonished Mr. Jorkins very much by making my appearance there. "Come in, Mr. Copperfield," said Mr. Jorkins. "Come in." I went in and sat down, and stated my case to Mr. Jorkins pretty much as I'd stated it to Mr. Spenlow. Mr. Jorkins was not by any means the awful creature one might have expected, but a large, mild, smooth-faced man of 60, who took so much snuff that there was a tradition in the Commons that he lived principally on that stimulant, having little room in his system for any other article of diet. "You've mentioned this to Mr. Spenlow, I suppose?" said Mr. Jorkins, when he'd heard me very restlessly to an end. I answered yes, and told him that Mr. Spenlow had introduced his name. "He said I should object," asked Mr. Jorkins. I was obliged to admit that Mr. Spenlow had considered it probable. "I'm sorry to say, Mr. Copperfield, I can't advance your object," said Mr. Jorkins nervously. "The fact is, but I have an appointment at the bank, if you'll have the goodness to excuse me." With that he rose in a great hurry, and was going out of the room when I made bold to say that I feared then there was no way of arranging the matter. "No," said Mr. Jorkins, stopping at the door to shake his head. "Oh, no, I object, you know. which he said very rapidly, and went out. "You must be aware, Mr. Copperfield," he added, looking restlessly in at the door again, "if Mr. Spenlow objects..." "Personally, he does not object, sir," said I. "Oh, personally!"